This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the film The Hurt Locker first opened, it seemed destined to be one of those really good films that gets great reviews, but only plays at select art houses and has a very limited audience. A film that proves the common wisdom that Iraq war movies are box office poison. But The Hurt Locker has been rescued from that fate. It was re-released, spurred by 9 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor. That actor nomination is for my guest, Jeremy Renner. He plays Staff Sergeant William James, the leader of an Army bomb squad unit in Iraq, whose job is to defuse live IEDs. He's the guy who puts on the protective suit, walks over to the bomb, analyzes how it's put together, then carefully cuts the wires. James is accurate and brave, but his fearlessness also gets him and members of his team into trouble. In this scene, James and the members of his team, played by Anthony Mackie and Brian Garrity, have been sent to check out an explosion. It's likely the work of a suicide bomber, which would make it outside the team's responsibility. Their task is defusing IEDs.
Jesus. So where's our trigger man?
Burnt up in the flames, man. Suicide bomber. We'll never find a body in that.
What if there was no body? What if it was a remote dead? A really good bad guy hides out in the dark, right? Right here. Perfect vantage point outside the blast radius to sit back and watch us clean up their mess.
Want to go out there?
Yes, I do.
I could stand getting in a little trouble.
No, man. This is bullshit. Look, you got 3 infantry platoons behind you whose job it is to go haji hunting. That ain't our job.
You don't say no to me, Sanborn. I say no to you, okay? You know there are guys watching us right now. They're laughing at this, okay? And I'm not okay with that. But turn off your goddamn torch, because we're going.
Jeremy Renner, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the nomination.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, assuming that you have to have some kind of like port of entry to get into a character's mind, what was yours for the character that you're playing in The Hurt Locker? This is a character who's willing to risk his life every day, not so much because he's a patriot or because he believes in the war. It's in part because taking risks and living in the moment is the only life he's good at. He's not very good at ordinary life. So what was your way into that frame of mind?
I had to figure out what fueled him. So I just sort of had to ask a lot of questions. And if I could tap into what fuels this individual, it makes him really an individual. It separates him from other EOD team leaders, other human beings. So I wanted to make him very specific. And so I had to do a lot of training in EOD. And that helped. And there's a lot of little gems that happened throughout the shooting process and the training process that also informed me of the bomb suit, putting that on. I had no idea what that would be like. But there's a certain walk that came out of that. There's a certain mentality and philosophies that sort of came to my mind about how peaceful and almost beautifully poetic that is inside the helmet and outside is chaos. So there's lots of things just kind of kept informing me.
Now, did they want to use a real Kevlar suit for authenticity and so that you would really feel what it's like? Or did you need a real protective Kevlar suit in case there was some kind of explosive problem on the set?
No, I don't think they put me in harm's way that way. And I know Catherine and all of us were trying to make it as authentic as we possibly could. I definitely wouldn't have chosen to have it be fake suit, even if I had that choice. Because the suit was such a big part of that character, a massive part of that movie, visually and then just physically. If it was a fake suit without all the Kevlar in it, I would have not walked the way I walked. I wouldn't be able to move the way I moved in it. Something very sort of lunar about that suit, you know, in the desert. It's kind of bizarre, and it's such a beautiful visual as well, so... It ended up working out pretty great. I mean, I have a love-hate relationship with that thing, but
right. For our any listeners who haven't seen The Hurt Locker, Jeremy Renner is wearing this bomb suit, and it looks like a space suit. And, you know, it's of course, protective in case a bomb he's defusing does go off. Since this is such an important part of the process for you as an actor, describe the almost ritualistic aspects of putting on the suit, getting prepared to make the walk down to where the IED is and to defuse it, and what it feels like to slowly put on the suit and have the rest of the world kind of drift away as you become encased in this protective garment.
You know, it takes a couple guys to get it on. It's, again, pretty heavy and pretty cumbersome to try to throw it on, right? And it's really quiet. All you hear is the drone hum of a fan in the helmet and your own breath. And you look around for snipers. You're looking around. You're looking for, you know, where the IED is. They're not afraid of the IED. They usually know how it's built before they even get there for half the time. So they're just, again, afraid of time on target and being down there and getting shot at, because they can't stop that. So it's just an interesting sort of kind of peace. For me, it was a very peaceful sort of, I don't know, I put Beethoven Moonlight Sonata in headphones inside this suit. So it was sort of a, I don't know, very kind of almost romantic kind of peaceful place.
Why did you do that? Did you know real soldiers who had done that?
No. I did that for me just to kind of put me in a very relaxed state amongst all the chaos and stress. It's made it sort of like a very kind of, again, it was a poetic kind of thing. And
Now, when you were at Fort Irwin training with real soldiers who were going to actually be defusing IEDs, were there stories that circulated about men who were blown up, or men who were shot by snipers while trying to defuse an IED? Or were the men protected from those stories?
No, they were very generous with their own lives, their own experiences, and very candid about kind of the goings on. I remember one thing that they said that I kind of asked about, like, why do you have a dog tag in your boot? And they all wore them in their boot, and they wore one around their neck. And it's like, well, you know, if you get lit up by an IED, usually you kind of disintegrate into pieces, but you always seem to find a boot. And he's just saying it while he's eating a sandwich, so kind of cavalier about it. And I'm like, wow, that's it's pretty intense. And he's just sort of like, yeah, you just find boots. It just happens.
Did you need security on the set, and did you have security?
Yeah, we had some security, but I never felt like we had to have it. I mean, it's certainly nice to have some Navy SEALs around you and some Blackwater guys. But there may be a few spots where it got a little rocky. You got some guys glaring at you that it looked like they don't like you very much. But for the most part, I mean, 99% of the time, it was perfectly safe. In my mind.
What was the other 1%?
There's a lot of Iraqi refugees that populate, you know, Jordan right now. A lot of Palestinian refugee camps. Very poor. And a lot of kids are running around. And I don't know. There's a few spots where I just feel like this, you know. There was one point where I was talking with Catherine. I had the bomb suit on. And we're going over how she wanted to shoot this one scene. And kids were throwing 2x4s with nails in them down onto us from 4 stories up. And she looked, yeah, we should probably walk away. And I was in the bomb suit, so I would have been fine. But it nearly hit her. And like, wow, we have to. And they're little kids. You know, they throw rocks and the whole thing. And, you know, we throw rocks back and have fun with them. So it wasn't, I think, anything really that dangerous. It was just, you know, it could have been a terrible situation for Catherine. She got hit with that thing.
Now, when you were interviewed on All Things Considered, you mentioned that you had a few breakdown moments, but you had them privately in your hotel room. What caused them?
Well, it's this, the strain, the physical strain was at first, and then it went to a mental strain, spiritual strain, in the sense of, you know, coming from California and having no experiences in the Middle East, and then it being during Ramadan, and just all it was compiled, a thousand things compiled, and I just tried to hold it together and hold it together and hold it together. And then every once in a while, I'd have to go home with a bottle of wine and fully decompress. And sometimes it just came out as a mental breakdown in a lot of ways.
You mentioned it was during Ramadan that you were shooting. How did that complicate things?
Because you can't, and we try to be as respectful to the community and the culture as we could. So eating and drinking out in public or smoking or whatever, everything had to happen at night. And then all the prayers, they have the mosques that go off, I think, is it every 4 hours? I can't remember at this point. But so they lay down the rugs and the things, so we have to sort of kind of respect all their religion and the practices of that. So kind of, you know, did it get in the way or did it help? I don't know. I thought it was pretty kick-ass, you know, to be honest with you. It was beautiful. It was kind of weird at first, those sort of chanting, almost moaning sounds that come out of these mosques, and then it was just became very beautiful as it just echoes through the canyons and the hillsides of this country. It was, oh my goodness, it's just beautiful. So yeah, it did slow us down, yeah, but I think it also helped us in a lot of ways.
When Catherine Bigelow, the director of The Hurt Locker, was on our show when the movie first opened, she said that she cast you in this because she'd seen you as the serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer in the movie Dahmer. Mm-hmm. He was a serial killer and kind of cannibalistic one. He'd eat the remains of some of his victims. And what she said was that you elicited so much honesty and truth and actual empathy for a character who she couldn't even imagine having empathy for, so she was determined to work with you. And she said she needed someone who has bravado and swagger and almost reckless quality combined with a profoundly capable skill set. She needed someone who had the authority to pull off that paradox. And she thought that you could do it. And, of course, she was right. Were you surprised that she'd even seen Dahmer? I mean, you know, really it was not a film that got a lot of play.
Yeah. Yeah, it was big within the movie industry and people within it, but not too much to the public. It was a small little $200,000 movie. I think on paper, I think I know why she kind of wanted me for this.
So she said
I was the only guy. She told me instantly, "You were the only guy to play Will James." And I said, "Well, here's why I think." And I went on for 2 hours on the phone talking about, you know, all the questions and answers that I had for her. I asked her how she wanted the audience to feel and all these sort of things at the end of the movie. But on paper, I feel like Will James could be very unlikable or could be very sort of callous or too cocky or something he had to be likable. Otherwise, audiences will check out and not care.
Since you got the part in The Hurt Locker based on your performance in Dahmer, let's hear a scene from that film with you as Jeffrey Dahmer. And this is from very early in the movie when you're choosing and then honing in on one of your victims. And you're in, I think it's like a sporting goods store, and you're looking through jackets and you're actually looking at this young man who's looking at shoes, and he's eyeing a pair of shoes that he obviously wants, but he maybe can't really afford to buy. So let's hear that scene.
Which ones do you like?
Those right there.
These?
Yep.
I'll buy them for you.
Why would you buy me those?
Because I like to do nice things for people. Makes me feel good about myself.
Are you some kind of nut?
That's sad.
What?
That we've gotten to a point where doing nice things for people is considered insane.
I gotta go.
All right, wait. I do want something from you. I want to buy you those shoes. Then in return, I'd like to take some pictures of you.
See, I was right.
Yeah, you're right. Still a good deal for you. I buy you these shoes. You just got to take a couple pictures.
Well, what kind of pictures?
Just a couple pictures of you, you know, making a muscle, sitting in a chair, you know, looking tough.
I don't know.
Come on. Let's get you these shoes.
That's an example of how kind of seductive you are.
I mean, how
you seduce your victims into coming home with you when they really shouldn't. And a little bit later, yeah. you kind of drug him and knock him out and then drill into his skull.
It's creepy. You know, I'm sitting here talking about it now. It's like, wow, that's really dark, man.
Yeah. What did you do to get into the frame of mind for that? Because it's not like it's a zombie movie, like it's a sci-fi zombie movie. This is like the real thing. Jeffrey Dahmer really did this kind of stuff.
Yes, yes. These are a lot of the things that happened in the movie really happened. And, you know, I had to approach that from a very sort of human thing. I couldn't judge him by what he did. I had to understand, again, what fuels a human being to go to these lengths to do these things. And then I was getting into abandonment issues and having his father not be around and not be able to communicate, terrible communicator, and being... a young gay man at 14, he realizes, and he's just, I had to come up with very human sort of behavior, and you know what again fuels this individual, and why, and I needed reasons why.
Early on, in order to make a living, you correct me if I'm wrong, you worked as a makeup artist.
Yeah, I did.
Now, was that special effects, or was it like lipstick and eyeliner kind of stuff?
No, more lipstick and eyeliner, more beauty makeup. Because I started doing a lot of stage, and, you know, we had to put on our own makeup to do these stage plays. And I remember, you know, when you live in a small town and you're 19 years old, there's not a lot of jobs you can do outside of Pizza Hut and those things like that, right? So I went through this Gottschalks, which is a department store, and I was fragrance modeling, where you get like $25 an hour to spray a card and hand it out to people during the holidays, right? So me and my buddy do this. I'm like, this is awesome. $25 an hour. Like, we're 19. We're like, this is great. And then a position opened up at this Lancome counter. And I decided, I'm like, oh, wow, maybe I should tell these ladies. Maybe they want a guy's opinion on makeup. And that's when it kind of sold them on the idea. And I trying to learn all their products and use all the ladies at the other counters as guinea pigs to constantly learn and grow and be a better artist. And I was always I could always draw and paint and that sort of thing. So I was just thought of the canvas as the, you know, the face. So, and understanding what light does with the eye. And again, this is awesome. I'm putting makeup on beautiful women all day. This is kind of a great gig.
And another odd job that you had, you worked for the police academy training cadets in kind of like a role-playing thing. So you were paid to pretend that you were who?
Yeah, they would. When we were at the college, when we were doing plays and things like that, they asked some of the people in the theater department to come over to the police academy on the other campus. And that was my first paid gig, by the way, as an actor. So I was really excited. So this police academy, it's a bunch of cadets that they're training to learn to become cops, right? So the actual real cops would say, look, okay, these guys are they're students and all, but, you know, we want you to treat them as real situations. So this is what they know. They got a call. It's somebody's unruly, and, you know, they have to come and see what the situation is. So be unruly. And literally, we're in a tiny little room like this booth I'm in now. And you can say what you want, do what you want. Just be unruly. So literally this cadet would come in, and as soon as he walks in, I push him to the ground and kick and spit on him, and he's supposed to try to arrest me. And then I got paid $50 a day to do that.
Were you supposed to actually hurt him? I mean, was that part of the deal?
Well, you know, I didn't try to hurt him too bad, you know, but I guess I made it as real as possible. But I didn't hurt him, you know, but enough to, you know, make it kind of realistic. And then there were situations where there was, like, you know, you find a dead body, or you know, you had to play like a little 6-year-old boy that got you know fondled by or something or whatever. And the women were actually really good at trying to sort of get that information out of you. It's interesting to kind of be on that side of it.
Mm-hmm,
it's so
mm-hmm.
funny. And I was getting paid, and like, this is awesome.
Well, I want to ask you finally about the Oscars. Were you surprised when you were nominated, and were you like waiting by the TV to see if you were?
Yeah, we were, Anthony Mackie and Catherine and myself were on the Today Show in the morning in New York live television, just to make it a little bit more tense than it already kind of was. I'd rather have been sleeping. But it was very interesting to kind of to do that. So I was nervous. I was very excited for the movie. I was pretty confident that was going to happen. And for Catherine, for me, I wasn't sure. I mean, it wasn't out of left field, don't get me wrong, that the potential was there for me to get nominated. But is there any guarantee? No. So the wave of pure ecstasy that came over me was the purest high I've ever experienced in life. It was pretty awesome.
Well, good luck. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Jeremy Renner is nominated for an Oscar for his starring role in The Hurt Locker. You'll find clips from the film on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When he was just 25, the Scottish actor Ewan McGregor caught the eye of critics with his portrayal of a Glasgow heroin addict in the Danny Boyle film Trainspotting. McGregor is only 39 today, but since then, he's made more than 30 films. He played the young Jedi, Obi-Wan Kenobi, in 3 Star Wars movies. His other films include Moulin Rouge, Big Fish, Black Hawk Down, and Velvet Goldmine. McGregor co-stars in the forthcoming film, I Love You, Philip Morris, based on a true story. He plays a man who lands in prison and falls in love with a charming Texas con man, played by Jim Carrey. And Ewan McGregor also stars in the new political thriller, The Ghost Rider, directed by Roman Polanski. McGregor plays a writer who's hired to finish the memoir of a retired British prime minister after the first co-writer turns up dead. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies spoke with Ewan McGregor. We'll start with a scene from the film. The Ghost Rider is sitting down to his first interview with the former prime minister, played by Pierce Brosnan.
You know the worst thing about my life? You get so out of touch. Everything's done for you. You don't drive, you don't carry money. If I need cash, I have to borrow it from the protection boys.
This is the kind of details we need in the memoirs.
I couldn't put that in. People would think I was a complete idiot.
No, not at all. No, this shows what it's like being prime minister. That's exactly what the readers want to know. How does it feel to run a country? How does it feel to be so cut off? How does it feel to be so hated?
Well, thanks a lot.
And so loved.
Ewan McGregor, welcome to Fresh Air. Your character is a bit like a blank slate, right? I mean, he's there to absorb, you know, the narrative that his subject tells him. And as yeah. you say, we don't really know who he is. Did you imagine a backstory? I mean,
not really. No, I didn't. I think there are certain things that we know about him as a writer, as a ghostwriter. You know, there's a certain kind of element of failure in his life in that he's not putting his name to his writing. You know, he's writing, adopting the personality of the celebrity that he's writing for. And in his case, we know that he's written a book about a rock star, and we know that he's written a book for a magician. And so we know these. He's probably writing about slightly cheesy celebrities and adopting their character for his writing. So there's a slight element of failure in him already as a writer that he's not even putting his name to his own work.
You know, one of the interesting things, we don't want to give away too much of the plot to the Ghost Rider, but your character gets involved in what he thinks is simply writing a memoir from a retired prime minister, and it becomes a much thicker story. I mean, the minister turns out is involved in allegations of war crimes that seems mm-hmm. to a lot of people modeled after Tony Blair and his involvement with the Iraq War. Did that kind of political side of the film appeal to you? Does it matter?
Yeah, it matters. It's nice. It's the point. It says a great deal about politics. It says a great deal about our politicians, and I like that. I didn't see that as being the major part of my decision to make the film in the beginning. I read the script very much through the ghost's eyes, and the political aspect of the film. I wasn't as bothered about at the time. And then now that I see the film, of course, and I see its relevance and how British politics seems to get closer and closer to our movie's storyline day by day, then I'm quite happy to be involved in that.
You know, the film was directed and co-written by Roman Polanski, who, of course, burst into the headlines really after shooting, I believe, when he went to Switzerland and was placed under arrest, you know, to face extradition to the United States for the, you know, his the incident in 1977 when he pled guilty to unlawful sexual intercourse with a minor. Was there any air of sort of controversy surrounding Polanski at all on the set? Did you have any qualms about working for him?
No, there wasn't any air of controversy working with him on set. His case and his situation has nothing to do with me. I wasn't involved in any of that. I didn't discuss any of that with him. Mm-hmm. I worked with him purely as an actor, wanting to work with a master filmmaker, and he's one of our greatest living filmmakers, so I was happy to be his actor.
Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about the other film you have coming out soon, which is I Love You, Philip Morris, in which you co-star with Jim Carrey. He plays a charming scam artist who is in and out of prison. You play his gay lover, and you meet in prison. And in the scene we're going to listen to, you're both in prison. You don't share a cell, but in fact, you are having trouble sleeping at night because a guy, one of the inmates next door, is screeching all night. And then you discover that he had been savagely beaten in the yard, and you suspect that Jim Carrey, your lover, may have hired thugs to beat up this screecher as a favor to you. And in this scene, you confront him about it. Let's listen.
Get up. Did you pay to have the screecher beat up?
Me?
Don't at me. Did you pay to have him beat up?
You hate that guy.
Just answer the question.
Yeah, I did.
Stephen. That is the most romantic thing that anyone ever did for me.
And that's prison romance. In the film I Love You, Philip Morris, with our guest Ewan McGregor and Jim Carrey. This character that you play, kind of a sweet, trusting soul, isn't he? Tell us about him.
Yeah, Philip Morris, he found himself in prison for forgetting to return a hire car that he'd hired. I think Philip was probably slightly forgetful and also a bit of a party goer, you know, and he forgot to return a hire car. Anyway, one thing led to another and he ended up in prison, where he met and fell in love with Stephen Russell, who was in prison for fraud. He's a con artist, quite an experienced and clever con artist, but not clever enough to stay out of jail ultimately, I guess.
Right. This is a true story. How did you build the character? Did you get to know the character, the person it was based on at all? Or?
Yes, I spent a day and a half with Philip. I flew into Arkansas, where he lives, and I spent a day and a bit with him, and you know I spoke to him about the details in the script to an extent. But what was more important for me as an actor was just to hang out with him, and we went for coffees and went for walks, and I was just able to see him and get a sense of who he was. And I was quite clear with him that I wasn't going to be doing an impersonation of him in the movie. I think our Philip in the film is a slightly gentler, slightly more tender version of the real Philip, who has slightly more of an edge to him than my Philip Morris in the movie. The script is a true script.
One of your early successful films was Trainspotting, which was you did with Danny Boyle, and a film, really, I guess, about a group of heroin addicts in Scotland. And I thought we might listen to a piece of this. This is from kind of the opening of the film. Let's listen.
Choose good health, low cholesterol, and dental insurance. Choose fixed interest mortgage repayments. Choose a starter home. Choose your friends. Choose leisure wear and matching luggage. Choose a three-piece suite on hire purchase and arrange fabrics. Choose DIY and wondering who the you are on a Sunday morning. Choose sitting on that couch watching mind-numbing, spirit-crushing game shows, stuffing junk food into your mouth.
And that's my guest Ewan McGregor from the opening of the film Trainspotting. It takes you back to earlier in your career, and we hear a very thick Scottish brogue there. Is that what you sounded like as a young man in Scotland?
No, that's a East coast accent. The book Trainspotting was written about a bunch of guys who live in Leith in Edinburgh, and on the East Coast, and that's a kind of strong, much stronger accent than I ever had. Yeah,
you grew up in a rural area of Scotland, is that right?
Yeah, in a little town called Creef, near Perth, probably 60-70 miles north of Glasgow. Right in the, but just before the Highlands start, very beautiful part of the world, yeah.
Yeah, and according to what's written, you knew you wanted to be an actor from a young age, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, my uncle is an actor, Dennis Lawson is my uncle, and when I was growing up, I was always very interested in him, and he would arrive, and he was a very colourful character. And Creef is a conservative kind of farming town, really. There's a lot of farming there, and it's a beautiful little town, but when my uncle arrived up, he had something about him that I liked very much that was different, and so from a very young age I wanted to be an actor because I wanted to be like him. But I suppose at the time I didn't know much about what being an actor meant, however I dedicated the rest of my life to finding out.
And how did your parents react to this ambition?
They were always supportive of me, and indeed, when I was, I started my penultimate year when I was 16 of school, and I just was in trouble all the time and sent to the headmaster and not happy. I didn't like school very much, and they wouldn't let me do the kind of things I wanted to do. I was interested in music and art, and my school wouldn't let me do that. They thought I was copping out, so I ended up having to do physics and maths and things that I wasn't in the least bit interested in. And as a result, ended up being quite unhappy, and my parents saw it, and they, you know, after doing 6 weeks of the first term of my penultimate year at school, my mother told me that. She said that, you know, she said, I've spoken to your dad, and if you would like to leave school, you can. And that was it. I never went back. My life kind of went into widescreen, and I was off. A week later, I was working in Perth Repertory Theatre, and I was a member of the stage crew there for 6 months, putting up the sets, taking down the sets. They gave me little walk-on parts now and again. And I was working in the theatre, I was working with actors, and I was being able to watch and learn about my profession, about the thing that I wanted to do. And so from there I went to a one-year theatre arts course in Scotland, and from there I went to a three-year acting course down in London at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, and started working straight out of my final... I didn't complete my last year because I got a job.
Yeah. Did acting turn out to be more difficult than you thought it would be? I mean, it's certainly easy to be excited about it when you were a kid, but you know, it's a mm-hmm. craft, right? You had to work at it.
You do have to learn it, but at the same time, it isn't complicated. I like to keep it very simple, acting. I don't think it is there's a great many tortured souls who are actors and make it very, very complicated, but I think it's quite straightforward acting, and I try and make it as uncomplicated as possible. On film work, you know, and on the stage, there are technical things that you learn through experience. And drama school is merely just a place to give you an environment where you can learn by doing lots of classes and different kinds of classes. But mainly, you're just in a safe environment where you can try to act and where your results don't determine your future in a way. So you can fail in drama school. You can be in a play and be terrible in it. And it's okay. You're not going to, you know, it's not going to affect your career in a way. Of course, once you come out and you start acting in film or on stage, then your work has some more danger element to it, because you can, if you fail, they might not get another job.
Right. Well, you got a job in a TV series, Lipstick on Your Collar, and then this film, Trainspotting, with Danny Boyle, was, I guess, sort of a breakout role for you. I mean, and there you're with a band of young people in Glasgow, I guess, who are using heroin. And I got to say, I mean, you were a very convincing heroin addict. How did you prepare for that role?
Well, we worked with an organisation up in Glasgow called the Carlton Athletic Club. They're a recovery group for heroin addicts. So we indeed worked with people who were no longer taking heroin. And we had a man called Eamon, who was our on-set advisor. Whenever there was any drug-taking scenes or heroin scenes, then he was there, and we were able to make sure that what we were doing with the syringes and the spoons and the matches and whatever was accurate and correct. And also, he was there to, you know, for me, I needed to find out what it was like to overdose and what it was like to withdraw from heroin addiction, because there was a quite a long sequence where my character's going through withdrawal, which is a horrendous and painful process. And I was able to question him about all of those things in great detail, because he had lived that life and was no longer living that life. But this organization don't use methadone. They just support each other off the drug, and they're there, and they organize football matches, and, you know, indeed we the cast, the guys from Trainspotting, we had a football match with the ex-heroin addicts, the Carlton Athletic boys, and they ran circles around us. You know, we didn't. They really hammered us.
Yeah. You know, this film has one of the most memorably disgusting scenes in cinema. It's a case where your character, Mark Renton, desperately needs to find a bathroom and finds what... How was it described in the film?
The worst toilet in Scotland.
The worst toilet in Scotland. And it is a truly wretched men's room, which your character ends up somehow dropping something he needs into the toilet and then diving in after it. You want to say a little bit about shooting that scene?
Yeah, there's something quite poetic about it, something quite beautiful about it in a way. It's odd that once he gets into the toilet, it's quite serene and beautiful down there, you know. I showed it to my kids. I've got 2 8-year-olds, you know, and I've got a 14-year-old as well. But one day I was talking to them about this toilet scene. And, of course, I wouldn't show them Trainspotting because they're too young. But I did show them the toilet scene because I thought it would be fun for them to see their dad going down a loo. And what I remember of shooting it was, you know, we did 3 or 4 takes of me. They had a very clever set where I could slide down the toilet like that. But it was, they thought they had it. And Danny said, OK, let's move on to the next sequence. And I suddenly thought, no, he has to go round the U-bend. He has to go round the bend. So when I get in...
In
the pipes, my feet should turn round as if he's kind of gone round the U-bend. And I asked for another take and put the... managed to stop myself just when my feet were sticking out the loo and turned them round and then carried on as if I'd gone round the U-bend. And I was very pleased with myself about that little moment.
You were in the 3 most recently made Star Wars films. You played the young Obi-Wan Kenobi. And I read that your uncle, Dennis Lawson, who was an actor, had played a very minor role in the first 3 Star Wars films, and that he advised you not to get involved in Star Wars. Is that right?
Yeah, very minor role in your opinion, maybe, but in the Star Wars fans, he played a very important role of Wedge, the star fighter, Red Baron, Red Leader. I can't remember, when I got closer and closer to being cast as Obi-Wan Kenobi, as I kind of got closer, I did question whether it was the right thing for me. I, up until that point, I'd been involved in mainly kind of independent, low-budget independent films, and I had a very, very tight relationship with Danny Boyle and Andrew McDonald and John Hodge, and we made, you know, Shallow Grave and Trainspotting and Life Less Ordinary, and I felt like that being part of that filmmaking team was my identity as an actor. I felt that that was the most important thing about my work, was being in that group of kind of new British wave of cinema. And I didn't think that Star Wars was quite who I was or what I was about. However, the closer I got, the more I wanted to do it. And I took advice from people. I spoke to Danny Boyle. I spoke to people I respected to see what their opinion of that was. And my uncle's just lived a life of... Star Wars a kind of overshadow... I think Alec Guinness was quite interesting about it as well, that after this whole life of amazing... acting, his whole amazing career that he felt remembered just for those 3 movies, or in fact just that 1 movie really that he was in. My uncle said, don't do it.
And that's because they're such obsessive cult followers of the films that you will forever be known as the guy who held the lightsaber?
Yes, I don't mind it. I don't mind that I am, because I've done lots and lots of other things. And for me, I'm very happy with the work I did in Star Wars. I'm happy to be part of that legend. I think it's great. And I really like being Obi-Wan Kenobi, I'd have no problem with it. I've always been quite open about the fact that it was they were technically very difficult to make. It's all there's a lot of green screen and blue screen, and for the actor, there's very often not another actor to act with. So you're playing to a tennis ball on a stick or a piece of tape on a green curtain or whatever, and you know, that's just not easy. That becomes a very technical exercise. It's always for the actor probably easier to be in a set or in a location with other actors to play off. It's just normal, you know. But that's just the way it is. Every film has its own challenges, and the challenges on Star Wars were being believable when you're surrounded by green curtains. In fact, most of the sets and the flooring and everything, you're very often just on a entirely green place. You're in a very green place.
Oh, really? And so the entire environment is added later.
Yeah, it's odd.
Well, there is some dialogue, and I thought we'd listen to just a bit. And this is you in a brief conversation with Anakin Skywalker, the father of Luke Skywalker. He's played by Hayden Christensen. So this is our guest, Ewan McGregor, playing Obi-Wan Kenobi.
You're going to need me on this one, Master.
Oh, I agree. However, it may turn out just to be a wild bantha chase.
Master, I've disappointed you. I haven't been very appreciative of your training. I've been arrogant, and I apologize. I've just been so frustrated with the Council.
You are strong and wise, Anakin, and I am very proud of you. I have trained you since you were a small boy. I have taught you everything I know, and you have become a far greater Jedi than I could ever hope to be.
And that's our guest, Ewan McGregor, in Revenge of the Sith, the Star Wars film. And you know, the reason I wanted to play this clip was that, you know, in this film you are playing Obi-Wan Kenobi, who was played by Alec Guinness in the first three films, and you're playing that character at a younger point in his life. And when I heard that, I can hear Alec Guinness in your voice.
Mm-hmm. That was my job, was to take the amazing and legendary performance that Alec Guinness gave in the first Star Wars film and play that character as a younger man. It was difficult to make that voice, put that voice into a younger body, if you like, because he's such a legendary figure, and we know that voice. We know Obi-Wan Kenobi's voice from those first Star Wars films so well. And to put that voice on a young man, it was quite hard to make it work. But I tried my best. That was my job, was to try and do that, you know.
You know, when you read about your career, one of the things people write a lot is that Ewan McGregor never stops working. I mean, there have been times when I think you've been flying back and forth between sets of two different films. And then some think that you haven't been selective enough, that, you know, that you should be more careful about some of those that you make. What drives you to the level of filmmaking that you do?
I just like it. I really enjoy working. I'm a working man. I have a family to support. I mean, whether I'm selective enough or not, it's very difficult to say. And it's really with my work, I like to have real freedom of choice in it. And I don't like to kind of confine myself by saying I'll never do this or I wouldn't do that. I mean, I wouldn't ever make a movie that was morally against my own, you know, I wouldn't make a film that stood for something I didn't believe in but I wouldn't say I'll never sing or I'll never do a sex scene or I'll never do this or that, because I simply don't know until I've read it what's required.
You know, the other thing I've read about you, I don't know if this is a record, but that you've appeared frontally nude 5 times in films. Is that just because you happen to be in projects where it called for it? Does it say anything about you and your career choices?
Well, I don't know what it says, really, other than, you know, movies reflect life, and in life you're naked some of the time, and movies are about the dramatic side of life, and sex and sexuality and love and romance are definitely in that area of drama. And so I think it's obvious that if you're going to have a career in acting and drama, you're going to be called upon at some point to explore those areas. And I have done. And that, you know, my second film was an amazing picture called The Pillow Book with Peter Greenaway. And it was a film about a girl's sexuality. It was about sex. And in that film, I was called upon to be naked a lot, and I was called upon to have sexual scenes with the actress and with the actor who played my boyfriend in the film. And none of that was gratuitous or uncalled for, because it was what the story was about. It was about a film about sexuality, and it's a really beautiful film. It's one that I'm, whenever I'm asked, you know, of a film that I like the most of all of them, that film always kind of springs to mind, in that it was a very beautiful and interesting movie, and probably one of Greenaway's more accessible films, I think. You know, I just never had a problem with it. I'm not embarrassed about being naked, but I don't insist on being naked in movies for the sake of it. You know, I don't right. say, well, we should definitely put a nude scene in here. And in fact, in The Ghost, you know, I was doing the press last week and somebody said to me, would you like to talk about the nude scene? And I went, I can't remember a nude scene. Is there a nude scene? And in actual fact, all it is when I get into bed at one point and I let the robe fall to the floor as I slip under the covers. And for the briefest microsecond, you see my bum. And this was what the journalist was interested in, talking about this huge naked scene, you know.
Ewan McGregor, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Ewan McGregor spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. McGregor stars in the new Roman Polanski film, The Ghost Rider.